Hello, everybody, and welcome to Supernatural Podcast episode Lucky Number 13 for Bugs, which originally aired in the U.S. on November 8th, 2005. And let's jump right into the recap. We begin in Oasis Plains, Oklahoma, at a construction site for a new home. One of the men falls in a rather deep hole where the ground collapsed and he breaks his ankle. While the other man goes to get a rope to pull him out, the man in the hole is attacked by beetles and killed. And it cuts to a bar where Sam is reading a newspaper about a strange local death, and Dean walks out of the bar with some money. He apparently won at billiards. Sam tells him that they should get day jobs once in a while, and Dean says that hunting is their day job. Sam tells him about the dude who is suspected to have mad cow's disease. Dean asks, "Mad cow? Wasn't that on Oprah?" Sam, a look of pure shock on his face, says, "You watch Oprah?" Dean, shifting in place and looking like he got caught with his hand in the cookie jar, changes the subject rather quickly. "Guy eats a bad burger? Why is that our kind of thing?" he says. Mad cow takes a long time for the effects to appear, and this dude's brain disintegrated in an hour or less. So they go and check it out, of course. It cuts to them zooming along in the Mattel car to Oklahoma. They go to talk to the other dude from the construction site and play the "We Were His Nephews" card and get the man to talk about the accident. So they go to the site and Sam goes down into the hole where the dude died to get a good look. All Sam found were some beetles. Sam hypothesizes that there were a lot more at the time and it was a bug attack. Dean is skeptical. As they argue, they see a sign for an open house and barbecue. Dean says they should stop. "And the free food has nothing to do with it?" Sam asks. "Of course not. I'm a professional," Dean retorts, and they park. They go to the door, and the developer, Larry, says that they will welcome anyone, implying that Sam and Dean are a couple. Dean tells him that they are brothers looking for a place for their father. They meet Larry's wife and the woman who is head of sales. She again implies that they are a couple. Dean tells them that he's going to talk to Larry. "Okay, honey," he says to Sam as he's leaving. Larry gives Dean a tour of the house, and Dean notices jars on the table, and Larry says that his son is into insects. Apparently, the son is sort of the black sheep of the family. Larry's son shows up with his pet tarantula, and he's on a first-name basis with his dad. Sam tells him to hold on, it will get better. Larry comes over to make his son leave. Dean found out that a year ago his surveyor dropped dead from a severe allergic reaction to bee stings. More bugs. So it cuts to them driving. Maybe there are connections between someone and the bugs, like in the movie Willard, about a man who controlled rats. Telepathy between people or elements and animals. "Yeah, that whole Timmy Lassie thing," Dean says, which of course is a reference to the old TV show Lassie. Maybe it is the developer's son. Dean tells him to pull over and opens the garage door so they can squat in an empty house and Dean can try the steam shower. So it cuts to the sales manager arriving home and taking a shower. A ton of spiders crawl out of the wall into her shower, and she's toast. Sam bangs on the bathroom door, telling Dean that another person was found dead 3 blocks from the house. Dean comes to the door with a towel wrapped around his head and says the shower is awesome. They go to the house and talk to Larry, who tells them that it was Linda, the realtor, who died. So, of course, they sneak into the house, and we see the police drawing on the floor where Linda was found. It is so cliche. I don't think they do that anymore. But Dean says, "This looks like the place." "You think, Dean?" They find a bunch of spiders. The weather is miraculously better with blue skies and sunshine. It was raining when they had talked to Larry. They follow Matt, Larry's son, into the woods where they confront him about the deaths. He says he has nothing to do with them, but that there is something strange going on with the insects. And he tells them about all the congregating insects. He actually shows them the place where this is going on. They find a weird place in the ground covered with earthworms, and inside Dean finds a skull. It cuts to a university, and Sam has a box with the bones in it. Sam and Dean are talking about Sam's relationship with Dad, and Sam tells him how he wanted a normal life. Dean tells him that Dad was proud of Sam, and even when they were fighting, Dad would swing by Stanford when he could to make sure Sam was okay. Dad was scared of what could happen to Sam by himself. And here's the first big step we see towards Sam and Dad making up. They go into the Department of Anthropology to meet with a professor about the bones. They tell him that they're in his Anthropology 101 class. He tells them that the bones are 170 years old and probably Native American. There was a lot of relocation of Native peoples at the time, and 60 miles away there's a Yuji tribe in Sepulpa. So it cuts to the reservation and they go to talk to a man there, an elder in the reservation. Dean tells them they're students at the university and he says, "No, you're not. You're lying." Sam asks him if he knows about the housing development in the Etoqua Valley. The man says, "I like him. He is not a liar." It must be being mean to Dean Day or something. I don't know. The man tells them a story that has been passed down for many generations about that area. He says, quote, "On a night when the moon and the sun share the sky as equals, the cavalry raided our village and murdered, raped. And the next day the cavalry came again, and the next, and the next. And on the sixth night the cavalry came one last time, and by the time the sun rose, every man, woman, and child still in the village was dead. They say on the sixth night the chief of the village lay dying. He whispered to the heavens, 'Let no white man ever tarnish this land again, and nature would rise up and protect the valley, and it will bring as many days of misery and death to the white man as the cavalry had brought upon his people.'" So Dean says, "Insects. Sounds like nature to me." The man concludes, "On the night of the sixth day, none would survive." The gas company man died on the spring equinox, the night the sun and moon share the sky as equals, and this is now the sixth day. Larry's family will be dead by sunrise. They need to get out of that house because they cannot break the curse. Dean tries to convince Larry to leave his house because there's a gas leak. He doesn't fall for it, and Sam calls Matt to work from that angle. Matt is the son, of course. Sam tells him to try to get his dad to listen. Dean grabs a phone and tells him to lie. "Make him listen? What were you thinking?" Dean says, rolling his eyes at Sam. They arrive, and Matt has told his dad the truth. Larry, extremely skeptical, of course, tells the boys to leave. But uh-oh, here comes the biblical swarm. Into the house, everybody. "Bug spray?" Larry's wife says. "Trust me," says Dean. Hee hee. With the help of Dean's bug spray torch, they hole out in the attic. Okay, so termites eat through wood really quickly, I guess, and we see light coming through the attic roof. Now, it's midnight when they arrive. Why do we see light? I guess it's a swarm of lightning bugs or something. But daylight comes, and all the little buggies fly away. Wow, was that one quick night. And where are all the bee stings and bug bites that they would have endured? I don't know. Anyhow, they drive by the house the next day and see the family packing a moving truck. They all say goodbye, and we see that the experience has helped Matt and his dad become close again. Aww, insert Lifetime Channel movie here. They talk about wanting to find Dad and drive off into the sunset. And we have it. That's the end. So let's move into the analysis. As you can probably tell from my brief little description there, that this is my absolute least favorite episode of the season by far. In fact, it was almost a chore to watch it again so I could do the recap. I thought the Native American story was really cool, and I like to learn that sort of thing, but the execution of the action and the plot line was, you know, was just not well done, especially the disaster of the ending, the attack of the bugs and the weird movement of time. Yes, I know it's a TV show, but the other episodes were not as disconnected and rushed as this one. So this episode is not only my least favorite, but also everybody else's, apparently. And I read this quick review over at tvsquad.com. It's from last November. It's by Bob Sassone. And let me just read it to you. I think he does a great job of the recap here. "Oh, great. An episode about a bunch of bugs killing people, going into their mouths and into their ears and noses. Why don't they just make episodes about all my fears? Maybe an episode about a monster that goes around scraping his fingers on a blackboard, or maybe clowns, or a bunch of fuzzy peaches that go around devouring people." The fuzz on peaches, yikes, that stuff just sends a chill down my spine just thinking about it. "This episode got me thinking, isn't it about time that Sam and Dean tell somebody about all the weird things that are happening? They're battling witches and demons and monsters and bugs and shapeshifters and killer kids in the lake, and they continue to fight these battles alone with no official help. I mean, even Mulder and Scully had the lone gunmen and other people who helped them and believed what was happening. It's not like no one else sees what Sam and Dean see. They're actually accumulating quite a number of friends and survivors on their adventures, so the authorities and or scientists that they could turn to for help would believe them rather quickly. But then, we might not have a show, so I guess we'll have to deal with it. Anyway, the guys investigate the deaths and find out from the local bug boy that bugs, Bees, earthworms, beetles, spiders, etc. are all meeting in one place in the woods. Sort of a bug club where they can all hang out and drink and maybe play some pool or watch football. The problem is, how the hell do you kill all the bugs? It's not like a monster you can stab in the heart of a mirror or you can smash to get rid of a witch. I mean, it's bugs. There are millions of them everywhere. I just saw a white spider on my coffee table. See what I mean? I'm glad Supernatural is on the air. It's not a brilliant sci-fi horror show like the first six seasons of The X-Files or the original Twilight Zone, but it's great to actually have an old-fashioned, fun, creepy show like this on the air. The problem I have with it, and I'm sorry I'm beginning to sound like a broken record saying this in almost every review I do for the show, is that I wish they'd get back to the whole idea of Sam and Dean finding out what happened to their dad and Sam's girlfriend. It's great that they talk about their father a bit in each episode, but they need to get back to the plot. I mean, it's kind of important. Cool line, one that I've used for years, so it's pretty funny to hear it here. You know who starts a sentence with, "The truth is, liars." That was the Native American elder to Sam and Dean. So, I like that article because it really emphasizes, I think, how I felt about the episode, and from what I've read on fan sites, but I really like his use of humor as well, so I just thought I'd throw that in there for you. And let's move on to the legends and references section. Again, there was not a lot to work with on this one, so I really kind of had to dig to the bottom of the barrel to find some interesting things. But supernatural swarms are obviously the first and foremost thing. Swarms of bugs have always been connected to the supernatural. Several old horror films have insect attacks as a plot line. One example is when the flies surround the windows of Amityville during the 28 Days of Horror. In the Bible, the eighth plague in Egypt was a swarm of locusts. In the book of Revelation, locusts with scorpion tails and human faces are said to torment unbelievers for 5 months when the fifth trumpet sounds. And finally, according to Plato's Phaedria Socrates, locusts were once human beings. Okay, now that creeped me out a little bit. The second thing are Indian burial grounds and curses. And I really came up with two major curses that are anywhere near Oklahoma. There is a curse of the Ohio River Valley. And this, let me just read through some of this. This is a really cool story. I was really happy to come across this. The triangle of land consisting of western West Virginia, southwest Pennsylvania, and southeastern Ohio has had more than its share of bizarre and fatal instances over the last 200 years, since the death of Chief Cornstalk. At the time, on the brink of the American Revolution, the settlers fought with Native Americans over land as they started to settle westward. Chief Cornstalk originally fought the white men, but later befriended them and was murdered by a couple soldiers as an act of retaliation. As Cornstalk lay dying, he uttered a curse on the settlers. Quote, "I was the border man's friend. Many times I have saved him and his people from harm. I never warred with you, but only to protect our wigwams and lands. I refuse to join your pale-face enemies with the redcoats. I came to the fort as your friend, and you murdered me. You have murdered by my side my young son. For this, may the curse of the Great Spirit rest upon this land. May it be blighted by nature. May it even be blighted in its hopes. May the strength of its people be paralyzed by the stain of our blood." And since that time, there has been an extraordinary amount of supernatural activity, including sightings of the Mothman, which I will discuss in an episode of Dark Gate Horror Podcast, and is thought to be one of the most haunted areas of the United States. In 1794, the town of Point Pleasant was established near the site of the old fort. For many years after, the Indian's grave lay undisturbed, but in 1840 his bones were removed to the grounds of the Mason County Courthouse, where in 1899 a monument was erected in Cornstalk's memory. In the late 1950s, a new courthouse was built in Point Pleasant, and the chief's remains, which now consisted of about 3 teeth and about 15 pieces of bones, were placed in an aluminum box and reinterred in a corner of the town's Two Indy Wee Park, next to the grave of a Virginia frontiersman that Cornstalk once fought and later befriended. A 12-foot monument was then erected in his honor. And this is not the only monument dedicated to that period in Point Pleasant. Another stands 86 feet tall and was dedicated on August 1909, 1 month behind schedule. Originally, the dedication ceremony had been set for August 22nd, but on the night before the event, the clear overhead sky erupted with lightning and struck the upper part of a crane that was supposed to put the monument into place. The machine was badly damaged and it took nearly a month to repair it. The monument was finally dedicated and has stood for years until July 4, 1921. On that day, another bolt of lightning struck the monument, damaging the capstone and some granite blocks. They were replaced and the monument still stands today. What is it about this obelisk that seems to attract inexplicable lightning on otherwise clear evenings? It's a monument to the men who died in the 1774 Battle of Point Pleasant, when Cornstalk and his allies were defeated. Could the freak lightning strikes have been acts of vengeance tied to Cornstalk's fabled curse? Many believe so, and for years, residents of the Triangular area spoke of strange happenings, river tragedies, and fires as part of the curse. Of course, many laughed and said the curse is nothing more than the overactive imaginations, but ignoring the death toll and eerie coincidences that seem to plague the region for nearly 200 years after the death of Chief Cornstalk. So, many tragedies and disasters were blamed on the curse, and I'm just going to do a brief overview of them. In 1907, the worst coal mine disaster in American history took place in Monongah, West Virginia, on December 6, when 310 miners were killed. 1944, in June, 150 people were killed when a tornado ripped through the tri-state triangular area. 1967, the devastating Silver Bridge disaster sent 46 people hurtling to their death in the Ohio River on December 15th. Many have also connected this tragedy to the eerie sightings of the Mothman, strange lights in the sky, and odd paranormal happenings. 1968, a Piedmont Airlines plane crashed in August near the Kanawha Airport, killing 35 people on board. 1970, on November 14th, a Southern Airways DC-10 crashed into a mountain near Huntington, West Virginia, killing 75 people on board. 1976, in March of that year, the town of Point Pleasant was rocked in the middle of the night by an explosion at the Mason County Jail. Housed in the jail was a woman named Harriet Sisk, who had been arrested for the murder of her infant daughter. On March 2nd, her husband came to the jail with a suitcase full of explosives to kill himself and his wife and to destroy the building. Both of the Sisks were killed along with three law enforcement officers. 1978, in January, a freight train derailed at Point Pleasant and dumped thousands of gallons of toxic chemicals. The chemicals contaminated the town's water supply and the wells had to be abandoned. 1978, in April, the town of St. Mary's, north of Point Pleasant, was struck with tragedy when 51 men who were working on the Willow Island power plant were killed when their construction scaffolding collapsed. Okay, there have been many other strange occurrences, fires and floods. Most would say that floods are a natural part of living on the river, although Point Pleasant was almost obliterated in 1913 and 1937. It might be hard to tie such natural occurrences to a curse, but what about the barge explosion that killed six men from town just before Christmas on 1953? Or the fire that destroyed an entire downtown city block in the late 1880s? Some have gone so far as to blame the curse for the death of Point Pleasant's local economy, an event linked to the passing of river travel and commerce. So there you have it. Curse or not? What do you think? And the second one is the Curse of Kaskaskia. 1735, when Kaskaskia was a thriving community of French settlers, there was a wealthy fur trader who lived there and who was remembered only by the name of Bernard. He lived in a luxurious stone home in the company of his daughter Maria, a beautiful young girl. Bernard owned a trading post on the edge of the city and frequently hired local men, both French and Indian, to work for him. Most of the Indians were hired to do the menial work, as Bernard cared little for them and considered them a necessary evil at best. At some point, he hired a young Indian to work for him who had been educated by French missionaries. As the two spent time together, Bernard actually became fond of the young man, at least until he realized that his daughter had also become fond of him, and in fact, they had fallen in love. When Bernard learned this, he became enraged. He immediately fired the young man and spoke to friends and other merchants, who then refused to put him to work. Eventually, the young man left town, but before he left, he promised Maria that he would return for her. Needless to say, Maria was heartbroken by what her father did. She pretended that nothing was wrong so as not to arouse her father's curiosity, but deep down, she secretly hoped and waited and watched for the return of her lover. Several young men attempted to court her, but while she feigned interest in their attentions, she secretly pined away for the young Indian. A year passed, and one day a group of unknown Indians visited Kaskaskia from the west. Among them was Maria's lover, wearing a disguise so that he would not be disguised by Bernard. Maria and the Indian arranged to meet in secret and then quickly fled Kaskaskia to the north. When Bernard learned what had happened, he vowed to seek vengeance on the young man. He gathered several of his friends and began hunting his daughter and her lover. They found them and captured them near Cahokia. Maria begged her father to understand, but he refused to hear her. He decided to kill the young man by drowning him. The Indian was silent as the rough trappers tied him to a log and then set him adrift in the Mississippi. Just as they placed in the water, he swore a terrible curse. He swore that Bernard would be dead within a year, and soon he and Maria would be united forever. Kaskaskia was damned and would be destroyed, along with all the land around it. The altars of the churches would be destroyed, and the homes along with them. Even the dead of Kaskaskia would be disturbed from their graves. The river swallowed the Indian beneath the muddy waters, and he was silenced. But the curse eventually came to pass. Within the year, the prophecy began to come true. Maria became distraught over her lover's fate and refused to leave the house or eat. She soon died and rejoined her lover on the other side. Bernard became involved in a bad business deal and challenged the man whom he believed to have cheated him to a duel. Bernard was killed by the other man. And the river began to seek the Indians' revenge on Kaskaskia. The river channels shifted and flooded the peninsula over and over again until by 1881, Kaskaskia was completely cut off from the mainland. The homes and farms were abandoned, and people began to slowly leave the island. The church was moved over and over again, but it did no good. The altar was eventually destroyed in the 1973 flood. By this time, Kaskaskia had become a desolate ghost town, but not before the Kaskaskia Cemetery was washed away and the bodies of those buried there erupted to the surface and then vanished beneath the river. Now, that's a small area in Illinois. So, again, what do you think? Do you think that the curse actually had something to do with it, or are they totally unrelated events? It's hard to know. But you can see a lot of those elements that I think Kripke tried to intertwine into this story. So let's talk about elementals. According to mysticism and mythology, elementals are creatures, usually spirits, composed of or attuned to air, earth, fire, and water. The elements balance each other through opposites. Water quenches fire, fire boils water, earth contains air, and air erodes earth. Water spirits are called underlings, earth spirits gnomes, air spirits slips, and fire spirits salamanders. Nature spirits, which include elementals, are believed to be various types of beings or spirits which inhabit nature. The belief in their existence was almost universal in the ancient era of religions which embodied animism. This belief that all things possess life is key among several branches of paganism. These spirits are thought to possess supernatural powers and are usually invisible to humans, save those possessing the psychic ability of clairvoyance. Nature spirits usually abide in trees, rivers, plants, bogs, mountains, and minerals. They attach themselves to practically every natural thing. In China, for example, they watch over the rice, silk, roads, gateways, and other things. In the Shinto religion of Japan, there's worship of nature, nature forces, and nature spirits. Nature spirit worship was also practiced by the Greeks and Romans, who believed spirits inhabited every glen, pool, and even the air. As can be seen, there are many instances of the universality of nature spirit worship. Elementals are of a lower type of nature spirit and are believed to exist as a life force in all living things. They are said to even exist in the four elements of air, earth, fire, and water, the planets, stars, signs of the zodiac, and even hours of the day and night. They are ruled or governed over by higher spirits such as devas or archangels, which in modern witchcraft are called lords of the watchtowers, the guardians, or the mighty ones. Generally, elementals are looked down as benevolent creatures that maintain natural harmony. The Neoplatonic Greeks, approximately 3rd century AD, grouped the elementals according to the four elements of life, earth, air, fire, and water. The elementals of earth are gnomes, ruled by the angel Ariel. The rulers of air are slips, ruled by Cherub. The rulers of water are undines, ruled by Tharis. And the fire elementals are salamanders, ruled by Seraph. Interest in the elementals increased during the Middle Ages and Renaissance when practitioners used alchemy and magic and sought to acquire nature's secrets so that to be able to control her forces. So there you have it. There's some interesting backstory for you and some true, perhaps, stories. I thought they were pretty interesting. There were two songs in this episode, Rock of Ages by Def Leppard and Rock You Like a Hurricane by the Scorpions. And the song of the night tonight is called See the Sun by Black Lab. Enjoy. Well, I did find an article tonight that I'd like to read. It's an old article from before last season started, but I like it, and perhaps you've not read it before. It's called Supernaturals and Eerie Natural for WB. It's by Bill Cavini. It's from the USA Today, dated August 17th, 2005. The concept, in the producer's Hollywood-ese shorthand, Route 66 meets the X-Files and Star Wars at a truck stop. Two estranged brothers head out in their 67 Chevy Impala to search for their father, who trained them to hunt for supernatural phenomena and the answers to their mother's haunting demise years earlier. With Supernatural, WB is pinning its hopes on scare tactics. Horror has been hot on the big screen, with films such as The Ring, The Village, and The Grudge all scoring more than $100 million at the box office. WB Entertainment President David Gianellari says that audience, more female than male, could flock to see a horror series, giving it a breakout potential. The films are scoring huge with the young movie-going audience, particularly the young female audience. That's our audience, he says. The series' otherworldliness is a reminder of early WB shows, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel, and the 20-something protagonists should be familiar fit for longtime network fans, WB veterans Gerald Padalecki of Gilmore Girls and Jensen Ackles of Smallville and earlier Dawson's Creek, play Sam and Dean Winchester. Gianellari sees the show as a thrill ride, just scary and suspenseful and creepy and cool. Its significance to WB is evident in a big promotional campaign that includes signs at gas stations, trick mirrors, which turn into ads for the show in bars and clubs, and multimedia magazine inserts. Supernatural comes in a season when eerie happenings are multiplying on the fall schedule. Other new fall shows, including ABC's Invasion and Night Stalker, CBS's Threshold, and NBC's Surface, also traffic in mystery and monsters. But Supernatural executive producer Eric Kripke says most of these are science fiction, not horror. Kripke, Boogeyman, joined as a producer by Mick G., Charlie's Angels, and Robert Singer, Midnight Caller, acknowledges the success of ABC's Lost in making it easier for these kinds of shows to get on the air. They reflect an uncertain post-9/11 spirit in which an enemy is not only out to get us, he could be living among us. Although Supernatural may fit with the times, Kripke, 31, has been nurturing this idea for almost a decade. He considers himself a disciple of the late Joseph Campbell and his examinations on mythology. The names of the two lead characters are an homage to the wandering Sal and Dean of Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And Kripke also cites contemporary signposts, including Star Wars and The Matrix, when discussing the hero's journey. Structurally, Supernatural will be made up primarily of self-contained episodes. They'll be driving into town to kill that evil, and then they'll drive back into the sunset, Kripke says. A longer thread, including their search for their father, will be established over time. Supernatural's apparitions will reflect a commitment to folklore. In their travels, Sam and Dean will confront a Wendigo, a man-eating creature from Native American lore, the Hook Man, the scary subject of many a campfire tale, Bloody Mary, a demonic wraith in the mirror, and a succubus, another kind of female demon. Although Kripke's research indicates a thoughtful approach, he has a visceral goal. We want to scare the hell out of you. And that's it for today, folks. I do want to remind you, if you've heard any good horror, ghost stories, whatever, it doesn't have to be personal. If you have a tip on a cool story that you'd like me to do some research and talk about, that would be really cool. Are there any supernatural type occurrences in your area? If you look in the newspaper, do you see anything that would go, I wonder if Sam and Dean would go check that out? Anyway, let me know at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. And yet another shameless plug for my Dark Gate Horror podcast, which you can listen to at darkgatehorror.blogspot.com. There are links also from the website. And I'm going to put links for all of the articles that I read tonight on the show notes. There is a really great website that has a lot of good ghost stories on it, including the ones I talked about tonight, and it's prairieghost.com. So you can check that out, but the link will be in the show notes. And I am really looking forward to getting back onto a good episode, and next week's episode for home is just that. I'm really looking forward to it. I think there's a lot to that episode, and it foreshadows a lot of what happens later in the episodes, so it's pretty cool. I do apologize for any delay in getting this episode out to you. My life has been absolutely insane, and so I haven't had time to work on my podcasts. Bye, guys. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you for listening to the Supernatural Podcast. You can visit my website at supernaturalpodcast.blogspot.com or send me an email at supernaturalpodcast@gmail.com. Please note that the opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host and not of the producers of Supernatural or the WB. The music brought to you tonight is from the Podshow PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com.